Oh, TC.
Hey, that's cool.
You got a podcast?
Well, I didn't know that.
Cool.
Now you do.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. We are back. Oh, that's cool. OTC's very own podcast and all the amazing people we work with right here at Ozarks Technical Community College. I, of course, am Jared Durden. And with me, as always,
is Andrew Crocker. How you doing, sir?
I'm good. I'm in a good mood. How are you?
I'm in a very good mood. I've had a good today I got to sit in on Strategic Planning Council.
Fun.
And got to OTC, or at least a few folks such as Matt Simpson, got to reveal how OTC has been doing in terms of its trends of enrollment and retention, and just kind of exciting to see, always kind of get a 10,000 foot view of where the college has been and where it can be going. You know what you just said, fun? You said fun. It is fun to do it, isn't it?
It's fun.
I think so, yeah.
I love, I'm a weirdo, I guess, but I really like big meetings like that.
I do too.
And hearing about the inner workings and seeing everybody I don't normally see and hearing all their perspectives and ideas.
It reminds me of something that you've said on the podcast a few times, where the comparison between the person who's cutting stones versus the person making the cathedral.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same person. The only difference is perspective, right? And I do feel like that sometimes when I'm in the classroom for several semesters in a row, that I'm cutting stones. But one thing that those meetings do is they do give you, okay, here's the cathedral y'all are building. It's kind of an exciting thing to do. We need to do a better job of picking like evergreen topics to talk about at the beginning of class. When's this episode coming out? It is currently like
the very beginning of February. So it is going to be the end of, or actually it might be, no, it's going to be the beginning of March.
Okay. You have St. Patrick's Day plans?
Yeah, so Aaron Dooley's comes out tomorrow, the next day, so the beginning of February.
All right.
And then
I need to be more mindful of that when I start conversation starters. But, in a way, I don't really care. It's kind of,
well, like we were talking about last time, is some people aren't going to hear this until a year from now. So,
100%.
I don't think we can ever just perfectly nail.
Maybe so, yeah. Maybe that's one of the beautiful things about the TV show The Office, is that it is purely evergreen. They never drop, well, they rarely drop pop culture references. And so it's going to be just as good like 10, 20 years from now as it is today. And Seinfeld's like that too, in a way, other than like the obvious technology that they have.
And the haircuts.
And the haircuts, yeah. Although I do think we are still, I kind of want to see a return to form for the Elaine Benes haircut, for the big draw of that, as a very pretty haircut.
And I've actually seen it, the earlier one with the big curly and...
Yes, yeah. And Seinfeld's not too bad either, but his weird, like early 90s New York coiffed hair that shoots up and goes to the back. That's not terrible.
Depending on where I am in my haircut cycle, I feel like I kind of naturally lean towards a Kramer.
Right. That's my bedhead look, is Kramer's hair.
I think that's kind of how I styled mine. Just up.
Mm-hmm.
So today we have a very special guest, as always. We have brought in an adjunct math instructor who is also an alum, a recent alum of OTC. Please welcome to the podcast, Alicia Swearingen.
Yay! This is exciting for us. This is the first time that we've gotten to talk to somebody who used to be a student of Mr. Durden's. Is that correct?
Yeah, I used to be one of his students.
Can you give me an evaluation here? What was it like being in the Durden experience, please?
I don't know. I have a lot of hype for him. I feel like you...
A little hype?
Yeah.
Oh, man. You don't have any destructive criticism that you could air?
I have some of my own. I think our relation started with me making a huge mistake, but then owning up to it.
Yeah.
And actually, it was, I've told that story before on the podcast about Dr. McGrady telling us to break a rule, and I ended up interpreting that as breaking my own rules. Partially because I don't know that I follow the rules in general. But,
right.
So I broke my own rule, and I had made a mistake in class, and had it in the past been very good about saying, hey, I just made a mistake, and I caught Alicia after class or before class and said, hey, I messed up. I want you to talk about what you were talking about, and then after that, we just continued to kind of work together.
See, you say that, and I don't remember that at all, to be honest with you.
I remember it every day. It kind of changed me as an instructor. But please, go ahead. So,
what was it like being in the Durden experience?
It was very... his teaching style is much different from all my other instructors that I've had. Now that I'm over at MSU and taking classes, like education courses, I've experienced some different styles, but a lot of my instructors just mainly focus on lecture.
Yeah.
And Durden's classes, not really that at all.
Yeah.
So I thought it was really fun, to be honest with you. At first, I was very scared of taking physics. Like, even though I'm a math major, and a lot of people that were in the same classes that I was in was taking the calculus-based physics, I opted for the algebra-based because I was just a little bit scared to jump in there. But I think my experience, I've worked as a tutor for OTC, and my experience there working with students and helping them really helped me in Mr. Durden's class.
Yeah, as a person that does not know physics very well myself, I'm basically a layman. I think maybe I've taken a physics class somewhere along the line. It's intimidating. Mm-hmm. It's an intimidating subject. For somebody who is approaching it as a layman, it just seems like an unforgiving field that is hard digits and facts. And I'm a social scientist. Everything is kind of squishy and negotiable and changeable with me.
I mean, it's essentially describing the class that I teach, though.
I know, right. And so that you get to, that's a theme that I've made a few times over the course of this podcast is there's really no way you can ever pay the people back who helped you get to where you are. But you can be their guide. Other people's guides that other folks were for you.
But yeah, honestly, I've stolen a few things that Durden does in his classroom, and I've tried to use it.
Every good instructor should.
It's my uncle teaches, and he says a good teacher is a good thief.
Good thief.
Well, yeah. Like Newton said on his gravitational thesis, I've only seen as far as I have because I stood on the shoulders of giants.
There you go.
Which is about stealing, but also about making fun of Hook, who was short.
Okay, that's good.
So tell us a little bit more about this. So kind of what was your overall journey? So how did you end up at OTC? Where have you moved on now?
So I don't know. I feel like I have to go really far back to start the story then. Ever since I was little, I knew I wanted to teach. And my dad, for whatever reason, decided to teach me how to do addition, subtraction, multiplication by the time that I was 3. So the really early start in math kind of pushed me to essentially dive into it. But I wasn't sure that that was the thing I wanted to teach.
How long have you been doing it?
Would you repeat your question?
How long have you been doing it?
Teaching? This is my second year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. So one of the first things, I don't know how much guidance you got when you were just getting started. Were you and Durden working hand in hand as you were kind of getting started to get some tips?
I reached out a few times, but not really, I don't think.
We did that summer of COVID. You were my assistant. And you were doing the, for a while I was doing that
ACE program.
Yeah, that ACE program that you were an instructor in.
That first year is the hardest.
Yes.
It gets easier, and you can start putting more Alicia flourishes on it, a process that I hope never stops. The second you feel like your class is exactly the same from semester to semester, you've gone static, my friend. But anyways, that first year really is the hardest. It is the hardest.
To be honest, I cried so much that first year.
So did I.
What reduced you to tears?
I don't know. I think part of it was like the expectations that I had when it came to teaching that there is a lot more to it than what I initially thought there was, which, I mean, with my education classes, I got a little bit of an idea, but it was nothing compared to, like, the actual thing. So I felt like I got really attached, and I put in a lot of work, and whenever things didn't go the way that I hoped they would, that really stressed me out and resulted into.
I was so stressed out my first semester of teaching. It was a summer semester, so everything's going faster anyways. And I was so nervous the entire semester, every single class period. I barely spoke in my lectures above a whisper. I was just very, very nervous. And by the end of the semester, one of our last class periods, somebody had raised their hands in class and they said, "Do you ever wear another color other than white or blue?" And I had realized that I had been so nervous that I had just instinctually been putting on white and blue shirts for like two straight months without detecting it. That was so ridiculous. You said you cried as well, Jared?
Off and on, yeah.
For the same reasons?
Yeah, because people aren't particles. They're not discrete values. They're messy and they have emotions, and then you realize it and you have emotions too, and there's this emotional labor involved in it that I knew about, I think, but once you're in there and responsible for it, and you know, you kind of, or at least I do, I want people to like me, and sometimes in our role and in that, you know, the balance of power, the way it the dynamic of the power, the way it exists, they're not always going to, and that is okay, and kind of getting used to that and comfortable with that. And
that takes a lot of work. I remember had to be maybe my first fall semester I ever taught. I had a class bomb an exam. They bombed it, and I took it personally, which you shouldn't. You should not take that personally, but I did. And so I kind of read the class The Riot Act, and in the moment it felt okay. It felt cathartic. I was like, you didn't take this seriously, and now you have the scores to prove it. And then as the class was shuffling out, I just felt remorseful over the next 48 hours until I saw them again, because I was like, those guys are going out into the world saying they can't stand me. And that is something you have to get over. Of course, I had to adjust my own methodology as well, but it's something you eventually get over. Are you at the get over stage yet, Alicia?
Working on it. Whenever, so my go-to person whenever I would cry was my uncle. Since he taught, he was a good person to go to that has lived the same or very similar experiences than what I have. So he would always conveniently call me on the worst days too, so I could always vent to him. But one of the things he'd get on to me for was taking things too personally. And I think I've gotten better. But that first year, I took everything way too personally, and I should not have. Because, I mean, good students aren't particles. They have their own stuff going on. And sometimes, like, we really don't see the whole picture.
Yeah.
So.
You can't be so readily quoting Jared. I'm not going to be able to make it through this if I have to go through two of you. that's really fascinating, the fact that he instinctually called you, like almost he has had an entire career in teaching, and he kind of knows when the natural stressful, whatever the opposite of a lull. Have you ever heard the phrase ebb and flow? Mm-hmm. So which one? They both feel like
ebb sounds negative to me. Flow sounds positive.
So
to
ebb
me.
Is when it's supposed to go up, and the flow is when it's supposed to go down. I just don't know what an ebb and a flow is. All right, you guys are my physics people. I was hoping you guys.
I'm saying the ebb sounds like the bad. That's the low. The flow is the high, or maybe the ebb is. No. Flow is motion, right? Ebb is not moving. So I would think that the opposition is when you're
flow
stuck.
Is not moving.
No, flow is moving. Ebb is not moving.
Oh, gotcha.
And so I would think that what it's saying is like you get stuck, but then you get into the flow, you get stuck. You get
so he naturally knows that your uncle naturally knows the ebbs and flows of a semester and knows when best to reach out.
I felt like it was just like luck almost that I'd get into my, and it'd always be as soon as I got into my car before I drove home and whenever he would call. And sometimes like that time actually differed based on the day. So it was just like coincidence. Yeah. I really feel like
one time before when I had just started, this is so great, I get to tell like brand new when I was an adjunct back in 2007 stories. My mom taught here, was actually department head here, and I went up to her. I think I had about an hour to go before a lecture, and we just walked around the building because I was like, I don't think I have enough stuff for class today. I have no idea what I'm gonna, what am I going to talk about? I'm supposed to talk to them for 50 minutes. I think I have like 15 minutes worth of material here. I don't know. So my mom gave me some advice that was inspirational and some that was very practical. So she said, you need to believe in yourself and understand that you're going to be just fine. So long as you don't do any more than you're supposed to, so long as you don't pretend you're anything you're not, you're going to be fine. And then she would also say things like, so if you need to stretch out your class, write slow on the board and say you need to burn an additional 10 minutes of class. Just write all the things, all the definitions, make sure you go up on the board, but write them real slow. That's what she said. I was like, that almost felt as good as the inspirational stuff. I was like, that's a nice little trick. If I have to burn some time, write slow.
I get so excited, I write too fast, and then my handwriting is terrible. And so that's been something I've been working on. But I also, too, I feel like there's some need to keep their attention. And if I'm just standing there slowly writing, I would get bored. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So tell us about where you are now in your own education.
Right now, I am working on my master's degree.
In?
What's the formal name? Goodness, you're asking.
What's the informal name?
Are you in the is it in education, master's in education, or master's in math, or both, or
master's in education? I believe the focus is on math.
So that's good.
It's been a fun time. I'm kind of sad. I've finally taken all my math courses, and finished my last one last semester. Mm-hmm. And it feels weird not having to do any more math.
What was your favorite math course?
Probably, I really like Calc 2, but non-Euclidean geometry was very cool.
Very cool. That's when you really start to see the abstract side of it. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Andrew, what was your favorite math class?
I took trigonometry, and I really enjoyed trigonometry. And math, I never wanted a career in math, but I was always really good at it because there was always one answer. At least in trigonometry, there's like an answer you're getting to. And nowadays, I like things to be a little bit more pluralist and more squishy and complicated with multiple interpretations. But at the time, the thing that just made the most sense to me was that there was always an answer.
Math does get there when you get into like differential equations, but then with differential equations, you either already know the answer or you guess and then work backwards.
Interesting.
Yeah. Is that how you describe it?
I don't know.
Okay, that's fine. So, I don't either. So we outnumber the people who do know in this room. He's the weirdo.
A little bit. So you're currently in your master's degree and you're starting your thesis.
Yeah.
Boy, that's so what's your topic?
I'm working on self-efficacy and mathematics. So essentially students' beliefs in themselves and their ability to do math. So since I'm alum, I went here as a student. But I also worked for OTC as a tutor for 5 or so years, working with our students, helping them with math and physics, because why not?
I bet you that's why you look familiar to me. My office is around the corner from Tutoring Center.
That's probably it. Yeah. So I'm like, we probably run into each other.
100 times, mm-hmm. Yeah, especially if you work there, yeah.
But
do you work with my good friend, Carolyn Snodgrass?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I got to share an office with her for a couple of years, and it's been a while since I was around somebody who I was pretty sure could match my nerdness step for step. She's a glorious nerd. I really, really like Dr. Snodgrass.
I love her name, but I think Sunshine Wolf has taken the place of first best name, in my opinion, at OTC.
Sunshine Wolf is by far the best name on campus. Oh, my gosh. Oh, Janky is right there.
Oh, that's in the third.
We always get back to Bob Janky every other episode, it seems. Best guy. We had a great interview, great conversation with him, but yeah, fantastic last name.
So self-efficacy, but you're also using, you're doing this surrounded, we were talking about earlier, you've been using a token system in class. And so your research has a theoretical framework looking at it through self-efficacy lens, but tell us about this token system you've been using.
So
a token system.
Yeah.
Okay.
So essentially what it is a made-up currency for class. Where students can buy exceptions to the course. So some of the exceptions they can buy is being able to turn in assignments late. They can also buy essentially reassessment for quizzes and test questions. So if something happens and they don't do as good, they are able essentially to turn in some tokens and retry on a problem.
How long have you been doing that?
Starting at the semester.
No. Early returns?
I haven't seen really anything yet. I think I've only had one student spend a token so far.
That's a heck of a thing to try new.
Yeah.
Like every time I try something new.
But do you see her eyes light up? Yeah. Do you see the excitement?
Whenever I try something new, I'm like, what if I used a different anecdote?
Half of these sticky notes in front of me are on it.
I should describe to our listeners that you have, really, this is A Beautiful Mind. Like, have you seen the movie A Beautiful Mind with Russell Crowe? This is A Beautiful Mind level of array of sticky notes that you have on the table right here. I'm a little concerned for your mental health.
You haven't even seen my house.
So, how do you earn tokens?
I have students. Wow. Students can earn tokens by doing various things. They can earn tokens through attendance. As long as they have no unexcused absences for 2 weeks, they'll get 2 tokens. And by unexcused, essentially, as long as they don't do a no call, no show. As long as they say, hey, I can't come to class today, then I'll take it. They don't really have to tell me what's going on as long as they talk to me. So that's one of the things they can do. We have online homework called WebAssign. As long as they get an 80% or better, I'll give them tokens, I think 3 of them per unit. And then there's also extra assignments that I have made for students to complete that are all optional that can earn them tokens as well. And these assignments focus on building study skills, and then there's a few assignments that focus on building self-efficacy.
What do your assignments for building study skills look like?
So one of them is students make their own practice test. So they'll come up with questions from each topic that we've covered and essentially make a mock test for it. Students can earn actual additional tokens if they trade their practice test with someone else, like Pokemon cards, and take someone else's test, then essentially they're practicing it even more.
I freaking love that.
Can I ask a weird question? Yep. Do you explain to them why you're doing it? And if so, what do you say?
Last semester I didn't, and I got a lot of students that did not like some of my assignments. And I think mostly because they didn't see its purpose very well. There's quite a few that I start off with at the beginning of the semester that are essentially just assignments where students write. And they're like, why am I writing in a math class? But they are there in place to help students kind of get this idea that they could be a math person, like trying to get that into their brains. Because a lot of students will come into this course and other math courses thinking, hey, I'm not a math person, but I have to take this class to get my degree. I'll just power through it, I guess. But I want to push for them to change that opinion. So this semester at the start, I actually sent out a blurb about self-efficacy, the things that it impacts. So they have essentially, like, I've told them that self-efficacy impacts resilience, persistence, helps with performance as well. So the higher self-efficacy students have, the more likely they're going to do good in a course. So I give them that kind of information. And then I also tell them, hey, here are some things you can do and why these things would help if you don't have strong self-efficacy in math. And essentially, they're all links to the optional assignments that students can do to get tokens. But I have a blurb describing how each one of them specifically impacts self-efficacy.
You also feel like that would lead to you enjoying the class more. And it's kind of a bit of a chicken before the egg. The students that seem to come to my class more, as opposed to the students that attend sporadically and do their assignments sporadically, seem to be enjoying themselves more. Now, I don't know which of those causes the other. They're enjoying the class, that's why they're there all the time, or they're there all the time, therefore they enjoy the class. Or, of course, the none of the above answer, which is they're just happen to be good students and such. But I can't help but feel like if you are regularly present and you're regularly engaging, then you're seeing the entire story as opposed to just slivers of the story that I think some of the less committed students might be going through. And I think that allows you to enjoy it more.
That's what I try to do. Award students some way for coming to class with tokens. Because I'm like, too, even if they're gone, as long as they do communicate with me, like, students are more likely to be successful because they'll ask me what is going on in class, what all they missed, what can they do to make up what they missed, kind of thing. And usually, like, those students are have a better picture of what's going on versus if they kind of disappear on me.
Yeah, I feel like, because a lot of times the answer to those questions are hard conversations. And so if you don't have some kind of rapport or trust built up, you can't really have those conversations, honestly, right? And because sometimes you got to be like, well, you're going to have to work really hard, but I'm here and, you know, come on in and let's work hard together. Yeah. And if you can get that relationship, then, you know, that with students that are struggling. But then sometimes it's just a matter of, you know, a much smaller detail and just having a connection can help with that too. So with self-efficacy, one of the things I found interesting about it too in my own studying of it is depending on who you are as a person and all the different factors that make us different people, there's different kinds of self-efficacy that are more important to us, right? Everything from doing well on things to seeing other people do well on things.
So there's five different sources for self-efficacy. We have mastery experiences, which actually has the biggest impact on self-efficacy. There's vicarious experiences, psychological mental states. Oh, goodness. Pop quiz, Alicia. imaginal experiences, and there's one more that is not coming to mind. But yeah, there's different things that can really impact it. And that's what essentially what each of my assignments are that are optional. They go through and address one of those different types of experiences students can have.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's very cool. We were talking earlier about, I mean, there's days where you get really stressed out, you feel really defeated. What kind of coping strategies have you developed or had good advice about? Because I know you talked about how kind of your uncle's first response was, well, just don't feel that way. But we know that, like, that doesn't always work, right? But I'm sure there's more to it. So what kind of coping strategies have you kind of developed or do you employ? How do you de-stress?
I've started boxing.
Nice. Where are you
for real? Outstanding.
I'm kind of sore. Yesterday was my second day, but it was really fun. But out of figuring out a way to, I think, have set time for teaching and set time out of teaching, I feel like helps.
Yeah.
I call my uncle, though. He tells me, instead of crying, call him, and we can talk through things. Like, just talking to someone can actually, to me, helps more than just sulking in my car.
That was usually what I would do. The answer I would have for that question when I'm stressed out, it's not what I do. It's like who I'm talking to or who do I get to do something with. A person will solve that for me better than most activities. But I haven't tried boxing. Boxing seems like that'd be a great way to work out some demons.
I think at least doing some kind of like physical activity for me gets my head out of it.
Yeah. That's how I am. That's my big go-to.
But, and especially like with boxing, I feel like I really have to worry about like my footwork, how I move my body whenever like I make certain punches.
Yeah.
Which it takes a lot of focus.
Now I'm a soccer player and I'm the same thing, really. And I always feel like I'm a better player when I am frustrated. It really makes me beat the tar out of the ball, right? But yeah, you're constantly worried about your formation, keeping the integrity of the defenses. I'm a defender, so keep the integrity of the defense intact and who's fast and make sure somebody's a certain distance from the fast guy at all times. And it allows you to dissociate is a word I would use. It allows me to actively dissociate from how upset I am about whatever.
So we brought you on just to get to know you, of course, and we love the idea of bringing on more adjunct instructors and getting that perspective.
Oh, absolutely.
And specifically, we want to talk about something that you and I have been talking about a lot and addressing to the best of our abilities, which is when you come on as an adjunct, you're supposed to say adjunct, right?
You are. That is actually how you're supposed to say it. I think most people stop at the C, adjunct. Okay. No, I say the T. It's in there.
I'm the same way with, I wear contacts, but is it contacts or contexts?
It's, I don't think either one of those are wrong. But you remember we had Carrie on. I struggle to remember her last name from Rooted. And I kept saying Rooted. And you guys kept leaning.
Rooted.
Yeah, Rooted is what I kept saying. Yeah. You guys kept leaning in on me for.
Anyways. So in the adjunct experience, which Andrew and I both started out as well, it can feel isolating and it can be challenging because, like you said, just like all teachers, when you're in the classroom, there's a lot that you're going through that can be emotionally taxing and requires a little venting, would really benefit from certain community resources. So we'd kind of like to dive into that, kind of telling us about your experience, the things you've tried, the things that you're looking for, and what resources might kind of help based on what you've experienced. So tell us a little bit about your experience.
I think, it's honestly been a little bit of a struggle since I work at for the Richwood Valley campus, and I don't really see a whole lot of other adjuncts. If I do, a lot, we don't teach the same content. So I very rarely see other math instructors over there. But I feel like another issue that, I particularly have is that I don't come across as an instructor. So if I don't recognize or already know someone, meeting new people can be tough because I feel like a lot of people look at me and assume immediately that I'm a student, which has happened quite a few times, actually. So getting out there to meet new people has been a little bit challenging.
I feel that, and that's been a theme of something that I've come back to the entire time I've been at OTC. Best job I've ever had, I would say, you do feel a little bit like a satellite. Now, folks like Jared and myself have kind of broken through that by being extremely proactive and really going out and tracking people down, but they're not brought to you. You have to go track them down, and that's harder as an adjunct. And so here on the Springfield campus, we do have like designated spots where adjuncts can congregate. We have those spots, but I mean, other than that, and half the time when you're there anyways, it's everybody's working. You don't want to intrude. So that's kind of a tricky thing about working in higher ed in general, I'm sure.
One of the things that I do like to do, there's a few people I will talk to at the Richwood Valley campus, but because I have worked at OTC on the Springfield campus for so long, I will just come over here and find people to hang out with. honestly, today, whenever I came over here, one of our physics instructors, Mr. Van Gordon, I went and looked in his office to see if he was here. So I caught him and chatted with him for a little bit about teaching.
I got to tell you, that's one of our favorite, if I may speak for hundreds of people, that is one of our favorite things to do. We love having former students show up and darken our door and step in and talk to a little bit of what their life's going on with, or sometimes just shooting the breeze. I love catching up with them after class is over, after the semester's over, and seeing how they continue to develop throughout life, because the nature of the position is we get to know each other pretty darn well over the course of 4 months, and then I release them.
And we have no idea what happens.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like building a table and you go, oh, here's this thing and it's done and the fruit of my labor. But yeah,
it must be like what dog breeders do when all the puppies are born and then they sell them off to people and the puppies go off in the universe.
That's an appropriate analogy.
I will say, though, I do get that experience.
Puppy one. Thank you.
Not that one. Thank you. But, tutoring students, I've actually seen last year about this time, there was one of the students that I tutored here at OTC. I ran into him on the MSU campus. And he was actually getting ready to graduate with his master's. And he was even kind of dabbling in math, which was exciting.
And the degree, he was getting a master's in math?
No, it was risk management, which it does involve quite a bit of
a lot of it, right? Statistics, yeah. And
yeah. But whenever I worked with this person as a tutor, they didn't seem very confident. So it's really cool seeing that change.
Yeah. So, there are some things that you've said that have worked for you, and to some extent you have to go and kind of seek those things out. One thing that we've tried is we started co-hosting Teachers Talking Teaching with Teachers. You still want to continue that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm down.
Okay, so, and this is kind of a formal invite to everybody. We will start again meeting once a month. That seemed to work pretty well, right?
Yeah.
And it's an open invite, and we'll sit in NKM, the second floor, 235 lunchroom. And whoever wants to come in.
Not the one overlooking the plaza?
Overlooking the beautiful new plaza. Mm-hmm. Any instructors that want to come in, adjunct or full-time, and just hang out and talk about teaching. Mm-hmm. We don't really keep it to, you know, there's not a leader to the conversation. Sometimes it's people needing to vent. Sometimes it's people wanting to talk about things they're trying. Sometimes we just crack jokes the whole time and have fun. What date then? What were we doing last?
Let's work this out in real time.
Yeah.
Honestly, I have the memory of a goldfish. I don't remember what we
can had. You do 2 o'clock? Is there a particular day that works?
Probably Fridays would be best, to be honest. Can't believe but I know no one wants to be here.
Can't believe I felt bad about bringing up topical subjects.
I know.
You guys are literally
trying to work out
something.
Business on. well, we'll figure it out and we'll get back to you, audience. Usually what we do is we work with Center for Academic Innovation, and they post it. One of my posters and all that good stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
Look for Alicia in MySpace. So
should I look for a squirrel?
No, that's only STEM Club.
Okay, so
this is our
faces. Never fail to have a squirrel in there.
It's kind of Python-esque with the mouth thing.
Yeah.
So, in terms of resources, any ideas or anything that as an adjunct you felt like I need this and I don't have it.
I'd say one of the things that I would like to have is being able to have like open discourse with other, like the other math instructors, and specifically instructors that teach the same class that I do, to bounce off ideas on how they teach specific topics, and how they approach different things. I feel like that would provide a lot of great insight to where I feel like I could, it would help me improve my course. I don't know if I share my token thing and they would like that if they want to try it too.
Yeah. We do have a statewide organization that does that. I believe Dr. Trish White is on it. It's like a statewide math instructors organization, but it's not OTC centric,
yeah,
which might be useful, but nonetheless.
But I was an adjunct, or not an adjunct, I was a graduate assistant over at MSU for a year, and what was cool is that all of our offices were together, all the people that taught the same class, and we would just go to each other's office and casually chat about what we did, how we taught class, and we'd just kind of compare how things went and steal ideas from each other and try it in our own classrooms. And I've learned a lot from just doing that, talking with the people around me.
It's so interesting, too, because, you know, Kara Griffin also teaches political science here at OTC, and she tells me about stuff she tries in the classroom all the time. And it goes back and forth. We both like to try things, but I don't think a lot of the stuff I do would work for her, or a lot of things that she does would work for me. I just think our personalities are too different. The material is the same. The person delivering that package is very, very different. And so that's interesting. I would be interested in, because mathematics, is there one way to teach mathematics, or do you think there's a variety of different styles that can go into it?
I think there's a variety of styles. I can tell you that, especially like starting out with the class I'm teaching, I teach it different than other instructors on campus. And I remembered being a tutor and thinking, like, teachers were weird whenever they taught something in a different way than everyone else. But
yeah,
I don't know where I was going with that.
Mm.
Has your opinion changed on that?
I am.
Their mind changed mid sentence.
I am all for the weird, the different techniques now.
Yeah.
Like honestly, that is the thing that I thought was weird as a tutor is actually how I teach my class now.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, authenticity is really important, which is kind of what you're getting at, Andrew.
I think so. And I remember when I was getting interviewed for the position back in 2016, we had a different provost at the time. It was Steve Bishop. Do you remember Dr. Bishop? Anyways, he had said that my adjunct, I'm kind of dunking on myself here. When I was applying for the position, he said that my student reviews were not great. They were okay, but they weren't great. And what he'd said was, if a student likes their instructor, they tend to learn more. And so being genuine and teaching in a style that fits you is not just makes good intuitive sense for your students, but it also allows them to get to know you better, maybe appreciate you more as a person. And as that connection deepens a bit, so does their appreciation for the subject.
Stephen Bishop gave me a... Rubber Chicken Award.
Rubber Chicken Award? And what?
I think I can't
what
remember
cause.
What he actually called them. It had something to do with creativity and teaching or something like that.
Yeah.
Some kind of thing like that. But I still have the rubber chicken, but its head got ripped off by my dog.
Dr. Bishop, give a shout out to him. He was, I do believe that he ended up backing me getting employed. Nonetheless, but he did ask me a couple tough questions, and that was one.
I run into him every... Well, I used to run into him more when I worked out at Cox South. I'd run into him all the time down there. So tell us a little bit more about how you teach. You alluded to the idea that some people might think it was weird or that it was a little more different of a style. That was kind of related to what we did in my class. But tell us a little bit about your style of teaching, where you feel comfortable, where you feel like you're doing your best job.
I feel like this goes back to me saying that, like, a good teacher is a good thief. I feel like I've stolen a lot of different techniques that I've seen teachers do. And
your style is a patchwork of other people's.
Essentially.
Yeah.
Like, my first unit, I don't know, maybe I wouldn't say I do lecture, but I do a lot of questioning. I'll ask students questions and push them to come up with the answers themselves. But it's just kind of casual, or at least to start off with. But students are figuring out information for themselves. I might have to ask specific questions to help them get there, but I really don't have to tell them a whole lot. For some of our other units, though, I've done different things because some of our other units involve more equations and spending... Having the time to be able to go in depth with them is challenging. So I'll ask them questions, but I'll give them like a worked problem already and then ask them what they notice, what they wonder, and see if they can connect like that process of the worked problem to the question that was initially given. And doing that, again, students can usually figure out the process on their own without me actually giving it to them. Sometimes they still need a little help being pushed in the right direction. But a lot of the time, like, I feel like I'm just there guiding them. I don't really have to actually give a whole lot away.
Are you helping them teach themselves? Is that what you'd say?
Maybe.
Yeah.
It's my approach.
They say you never learn more than when you teach yourself. Or they you never learn more than when you teach.
I'd say my approach for teaching, though, is probably most similar to how I tutored. Like, it's essentially, it was just me asking students questions all the time.
Yeah.
But essentially, sometimes I'll do it. We'll have class discussions. Sometimes I'll throw them in groups and have them work a challenging problem, or if it's a new thing that I want them to figure out, I'll throw them in groups so they have other people to back ideas on. And then after they're in groups, they'll share whatever they've worked on. Sometimes we have a casual class discussion. Sometimes I hide from my students and...
she learned that from me.
They think it's hilarious too because I just dive behind the desk and then they just see my feet kick because I just lay on the floor. But I'll hide from them and let them talk. And essentially, again, that's
is that is that why you hide? Why are you hiding?
How would you explain it?
It's so students could say that the information is their own, that they're the ones that figured it out. They're the ones that are explaining it to other people. So essentially, so the other groups know what's going on.
Yeah.
And they don't look for me for the answers. It's them doing the stuff, not me doing the stuff.
And that's based in sociocultural research. So that's one of the papers I did in my weird stuff where it's it's called implicit and explicit action.
That's part of self-efficacy too.
That's part of self-efficacy. So the implicit action there is, you know, we frame, we do a lot of framing. So like our brain's doing things that we don't realize it's doing. For example, when you look at a room and the chairs are in rows, you put in all these expectations and you kind of set yourself ready to sit down and listen and maybe be bored. Mm-hmm. If you see, you know, lab tables set up, you expect to work with other people. If the instructor's standing in front of you, your expectation is you're going to sit there and you're going to listen to them. They're going to talk. And even when you try to get students to talk to each other, they'll still look at you and they'll keep looking to the instructor. And so I started hiding. Like she said, I just get behind a table and maybe there's 30 seconds of silence before finally they're kind of, they just start talking.
Yeah.
And then they get comfortable in it and then they start talking to each other. And so you're kind of cueing them by where you position yourself. So
there's all this great research on that in communication. Mm-hmm. My master's is in communication. And one of my favorite studies is how people stand just on elevators. When the first person gets on the elevator, they press the button and then they stand in the middle in the back of the elevator. And then when the second person gets on, the first person goes and they like work, stay by the buttons, and the second person stands the opposite corner.
Yeah.
And then the third person comes on, and the third person tends to stay in a particular spot as well. It's fascinating that just like the actual physical space in a room can dictate how the room will
absolutely
will be. Yeah.
And in the elevator, I always feel like it's my responsibility to make everybody else feel comfortable. So like I try to position myself where everybody can be the most comfortable they could be.
You might need therapy for that. I don't know if that's a healthy impulse.
That might be the confession.
But like going to your example of like the elevator,
yeah.
I feel like with being in the elevator, you have set expectations almost where you should be.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's kind of relates to teaching though.
Oh, for sure.
That students have set expectations on how like essentially what it means to be a teacher. And that's why I really feel like they do just look at us for all of the knowledge. I'm just like they have it in them. We just got to drag it out almost.
Which is why, you know, looking into efficacy is so important, because that's one of the things we want to build, right? And you know, when you talk about teaching and learning, it implies that you have to be taught to learn, but that's not what learning is, right? When you ask someone what they're really good at, they're not going to tell you it's a thing that someone told them while they sat down, right? Like the thing I'm really good at is the thing that I was up doing and trying and failing and communicating with other people about in a community of practice, right? Whether it was my home or my sports team or whatever, right? And so learning is participation, right? It's not this, you're not a jar that people are pouring things into.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of negotiating how you make that happen. When you start as a teacher looking at yourself as a facilitator, you know, creating opportunities for them to do that, I think you start to come up with all kinds of ideas like Alicia's talking about.
Yeah.
So, I like this idea. So you've kind of got this amalgam now, this patchwork that obviously, as you've seen, you know, you keep reworking and evolving, which is, you know, to compliment you on is, I think, one of the most important things about being a teacher, that you're never going to be perfect, and you're always looking to, you know, take in data, be informed, and say, okay, well, now I'm going to try this. Like, and you just keep trying things and seeing what's working and paying attention to your population. Have you seen a big shift in students? Have you seen, like, what are some of the things that have happened or experiences you've had where you're like, okay, this needs adjusting?
I try to facilitate a classroom in such that in a way that students feel comfortable sharing those kinds of things. And honestly, last semester I had students share quite a few things that needed to be adjusted. But sometimes I can tell, though, like if students don't want to complete an assignment, that's usually a big flag of they don't want to do it and there's something going on, some reason why it's not being done. And I actually saw that with one of the assignments I made last semester and asked students about it. They didn't like it. They thought, and honestly, I agree with them, that it was a lot of work for essentially like the amount of time that we had. And I, after their feedback on it, I tried to adjust the assignment, but honestly, this semester I went ahead and got rid of it because essentially it ties to what I'm doing with tokens, so I'm making them do it anyway, but in a less time-consuming way, and hopefully then it's more beneficial for them. But like to add, students tell me that they didn't like my handouts, which...
It hurts sometimes.
To be honest, at the time, I didn't really see it. Like, I didn't see the problem. But I went ahead and made adjustments like they asked anyway. And prepping for this semester, oh, man, I totally see what they were saying.
Yeah.
And honestly, I kind of feel bad about the quality of the handout that I gave them. But
don't be hard on yourself. Well, your handouts are fine, I'm sure.
Honest, at the time, it was the best. I was giving them, and I try to approach things is that I'm going to give students the best education that I can give them at that moment in time. So it's kind of just based off of what I know. And at that point in time, or this time last semester, I did not see essentially the problem. Like, I was giving them the best that I had. But now that I realize that essentially my problems that I was giving students wasn't on the same scale of the homework, and I needed to adjust that. Now that I know that's a problem, I've corrected it for this semester. But I've gotten a few other things from students that they'll share with me that they didn't like, and which is okay. And like, this is their class as well, so they'll take that feedback and I'll try to adjust to make the class better.
It's a negotiation. Mm-hmm. Something I noticed that whenever I see an assignment, if I see a lot of students plagiarizing. So if I get an assignment where all of a sudden I see, you know, it's basically the same thing, or I can tell they've copied it from some other source, that's a big red flag for me that, you know, I don't think that happens. A lot of students don't make that choice unless they feel a lot of pressure, right? And it's kind of like, and if I'm pressuring them to the point where they break and they do something that's morally compromising, that's like a, oh, wait, maybe that's not a best assignment then at that time. Either they don't have enough time, they haven't had enough preparation, and that can be really damaging, I think, to their efficacy and just, you know, general habits, because you want to help develop these good habits, and that's not one of them. Have you seen the, I need to show you this while we're here today, too. So we had a group that include Daniel Kospis. Have you ever had class with him?
I haven't had a class with him, but I worked with him as a tutor.
So he was on a group that we won one of the innovation grants, and it's to build a modular classroom. And so all the tables are movable, but it also they're all whiteboard top tables.
Mm.
Can I come work on this campus now?
I cannot make those decisions. But I'll show you this room. Are you still using whiteboards or just the classroom boards? Or
I still have the whiteboards that you gave me. I mean, some of them are pretty rough shape, but they're still usable.
Yeah.
So, but honestly, right now, I don't have very many students in my class, so I don't need very many.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'll have students work on essentially really big whiteboards that aren't up in the front of the classroom, so they can move them, put them wherever they want to have them, and they can work on a whiteboard together as a group, and then I'll have them share information that way.
And I know that's something Daniel started doing as well, too.
I've heard about that, yeah.
Yeah, he's got some great, he did just a ton of work, too, on making his online classes really exceptional, I think, and definitely someone if you get the chance to talk to, if any math instructors are listening.
Honestly, there's Daniel Kospis and Melissa Whitmer, and I like cheer them on whenever I'm in my class, and I they both have websites that essentially have YouTube videos that they share with their students to help them. But honestly, I've kind of copied and pasted those websites into my own class and share with my own students because they are really helpful and beneficial. And honestly, I'll share them with students that even like for extra practice, they can go click on one of those videos, copy down the problem, try it, and then boom, there's already an explanation there. But yeah, those are actually some people I should probably talk to. But it's sometimes that's hard to do being on the Richwood Valley campus. It's not easy to just peek into someone's office and be like, hey, what's up?
Well, if you're at the Richwood Valley campus, go say hi to Alicia.
And oh, please. You're
on the Springfield campus, we'll announce, and if you hear about teachers talking, teachers teaching teachers.
TTTWT.
It was teachers talking, teaching with teachers. If you see that advertisement, join us for that and come meet her and have conversations as well.
Alicia will be the one in the faculty room who looks like a student. You'll think, why is this student in here? That's not a student.
Why is this child in here?
And just reach out in general. Let us know what you think. And if you're interested in kind of doing some community building stuff, if you're an adjunct out there looking for some community, reach out to us and let us know your ideas on that as well. Andrew, we've learned a lot about this token system, about self-efficacy, about
so cool
being a graduate student, being an adjunct, and frankly, I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
Well, now you do.
All right. Thanks so much. Thank you.